Little Emily biting her sister, or is teenage Barry refusing to help around the house? Consulting psychologist David Carey joins us to answer all your parenting woes.
Yes, it is time for parenting. We are joined once again by the child and adolescent psychotherapist and the author of the best-selling book, Cop On, Coleman Nachter. Coleman, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Sean.
And happy Christmas. Coleman's turned up in his Christmas jumper, so we have to salute his Christmassiness today. But it's what you do at work today, isn't that right?
Yeah, but I work in St. Patrick's Hospital, obviously, and there's going to be some young people who are going to be in over Christmas, so staff all wore their Christmas jumpers today. So.
And yours is very fetching.
Thank you.
I must say. First question is this. I have a 16-month-old son who suddenly developed a fear of the bath and cries as soon as we put him in it. We tried sitting him beside the sink to give him a quick wash. That made him cry too. So it seems to be a sudden fear of water. He always loved the bath, and nothing happened to scare him during that, we noticed, as there was always someone with him at all times during bath time, says Teresa.
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual one that it's kind of started when he used to enjoy it. But I mean, we always kind of look for a moment that may have caused a kind of an association. Sometimes these associations are just in the baby's head and they don't seem to be that obvious at all. So the key here is to try and reassociate bath time as something more pleasurable. And I think there's a few tips you can do with that. I mean, I think sometimes a child in a big bath can feel very unsafe, that if there's no non-slip mats and things like that, they can feel like it might be toppled over, and they can kind of get anxious around that idea. So sometimes putting a kind of a baby bath in a bath can help to try and make the child feel a little bit more secure. One of the things that's common enough is a child can get kind of scared or freaked out by taking the plug out, because, you know, the gurgling noises of the water going. So just maybe remove the child out of the bathroom before doing that. But I would say just try and reintroduce it slowly at their pace. I mean, he will get back into the bath again without a doubt, but trying to make it more fun by bringing toys into the bath if he has a sibling to bath with them. Some babies love sitting in the bottom of a shower, you know, and once the water's spraying away from them, they can kind of enjoy that. So just be creative around trying to reassociate that, the experience of being bathed, with something that was previously pleasurable.
And because he's a baby, you're never going to be able to figure out what it was that scared
Absolutely
him in the
not.
First place.
Absolutely not. And again, I think there is that kind of sense of feeling secure in the bath, and that can sometimes only come over time, that you become aware that you might be able to fall or slip, and so the child might just become nervous the more aware they are. And I oftentimes make the comparison to roller coasters. When I was a kid on a roller coaster, it was like faster, faster, whereas I go on it now as an adult, I'm more aware of, has this thing been serviced?
And oh yeah, I do that. I figure out where I will land when the thing snaps off. Yeah.
So sometimes the more we are aware, the more we learn, the more scary things can become.
That's true, that's very true. So it's just patience, really.
Pretty much, and stick at it. And you know, again, the child needs to be washed and they need to be bathed and sponge bath. And sometimes, you know, putting them in the bath and just leaving it, the empty bath, and just washing them that way and gradually moving at their pace. But they will get over it. But there's no need to force them through anything terribly traumatic at this point. It'll come in its own time.
My 3.5-year-old still joins us in bed every night. Good luck with that. I don't mind it, but it has resulted in us having broken sleep now for what seems like forever. I'm guessing 3.5 years is the forever. I'm used to it, but would like to get a full night's sleep at some stage. How do I get him to stay in bed?
Put him back there. That's the short answer. No, I mean, again, I I always kind of have more empathy for things that happen at night, and that's my own. I'm a lot more reasonable at 2 o'clock in the afternoon than 2 o'clock in the morning, and
we
I think
all are.
So. It's a measure of modern day life. You know, both parents working. The thoughts of going in and out at 2 a.m, just, you know, throw back the blanket and get them in and allow them and settle in a few minutes and continue your night's sleep. But if it's happening for 3.5 years, then that's a pattern that's starting to become quite ingrained and entrenched. There is no easy way for this one. This is one of those hard slog things, which is returning them gently back to their bed and not engaging in much chat and, you know, resettling them, going back to your own bed. Undoubtedly they'll try again. You do the same, repeat, and you'd need to do that for maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks before they'll start to get the message that they need to stay there. But it's one of those things that I think, as it's so easy to say it as a, another parent to kind of say, oh, you just do that.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to be critical of parents who are in that position. But I just genuinely, having been in that position of, you know, the nighttime caller, you have a moment or two to think, do I really want to do this, or do I just throw back the blanket? And I think in terms of it's understandable, but it's not healthy in that child. As like I said before, you know, if you're allowing the child into the bed, if they're scared or something like that, then it might need a little bit more intervention. Mm. But if it's just habit, you're just trying to reprogram that habit by returning them to their own quarters and you know, to teach them that there's nothing to be frightened of there, whereas letting them into the bed can sometimes reinforce a fear that they have. So no easy answers on this one. Parenting is just return them, go through a kind of a period of a week or two of persistence, and they'll reassociate that they can stay there all night.
Well, I suppose the difficulty is at 3.5, they can walk, they can talk, they can say no.
Yes.
And they can also reason, I suppose, to the extent of, well, you've let me do this up to now, why aren't you not letting me do it now?
Yeah, and again, that's one of the drawbacks of letting it happen up to now. But again, it's something that for them and for their own, like at 3.5, maybe that's not alarming, but maybe at 6.5, 7.5, 8.5, it's still happening.
Then
you're kind of having to have a bigger difficulty now. So the why now is kind of, I've had enough, and it might not seem reasonable to them, but it is reasonable in the longer term.
Maybe they kind of need to kind of, because she says us, so at least there's a couple there. And they can divide up the order of who brings Baba back to bed.
For sure.
And what nights and how all that works out. So at least maybe, you know, they're guaranteed to get 4 hours sleep.
And I think she said it doesn't bother me, which may suggest it bothers somebody else. But I think it's something, it's a bit of a program that's well worth investing in, because then you've got that problem resolved. Whereas if you kind of don't stick to it or not consistent and say send them back one night but let them in the next night, you're sending all the kind of wrong mixed messages, unfortunately.
My son is afraid of having a number two. He does a number one, no problem. And he doesn't seem to have an issue with his digestion. Any advice? Now, when they say he doesn't seem to have, I wonder, have they brought them to a GP just to be sure?
Yeah, I mean, the problems of digestion it's more something to do with constipation. And again, in this, like in all small children, you'll see the difficulties arise around the things that they can control. So you'll have feeding problems, you'll have pooing problems, and you'll have eating problems, because they're the three things that a toddler can exert control over. They can refuse to eat, poo, and behave. And so from that point of view, they're going to exert that control in those areas. So oftentimes you'll have childhood behavioural problems will come through that. Now, the pooing incident around with the number two, that could be an issue of, you know, it could be an anxiety, or it could be just a physical problem. What happens is a child may have a difficult or sore bowel movement, and they'll go, "That ouch, that's really sore."
Yeah.
So when they feel the next one coming on, they hold it in order to not go through the pain again, which worsens the constipation experience, which means the next bowel movement is sore also. Mm-hmm. And so they develop this kind of holding habit, and that can reinforces that it's really, really painful. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to tell the child that more regularly they poo, the less painful it's going to be. The other thing is that sometimes a toilet is just too big for a child.
And,
you know, trying to bear down and hold your weight on a large adult-sized toilet seat can be quite unnerving for a child, and especially if they're under pressure to make the bowel movement, a little toilet insertion or a stool can make them feel a lot more at ease there. But I wouldn't be too quick to say that it isn't a digestion problem. A lot of children's diets don't necessarily have enough fluids in them at that age, you know, trying to get fluids through, fibers, brands, that sort of stuff will just soften the bowel motion, and will perhaps, when you're trying to train them into being able to take the confidence to have the poo that it won't hurt, then you're going to have a better sense, because there's no point in you saying it's not going to hurt and then it does. I just know from own personal experience that, you know, my little fella would have had problems with the constipation, and you know, it's an unexplainable pain when it's happening.
Yeah.
And like anyone, you want to avoid that. So if you know that holding it doesn't cause that pain, then you're going to do that. So again, trying to help them to go regularly. I would keep an eye on the diet, and just make sure that their toileting environment is comfortable for them. But it's a very easy vicious circle for small children to get into. And if you think of it from their point of view, it's understandable.
Yeah, absolutely. So, would you, in terms of the, like the, that fear of the big toilet, a little potty or something that's theirs? Does that, can yeah. that make them feel a bit more comfortable?
Yeah, again, if you give them ownership over the process, they feel a bit more in control of it. And again, it's really about not creating tension in this. And I remember, you know, kind of myself and my son had a running joke around a poo face, you know, and kind of making that a kind of a fun time. And it creates a kind of a relationship that this is something to be enjoyed and as well as endured. And so, but yeah, I mean, I think if he's gone from potty to toilet, then maintain the toileting use. But those little toilet insertions, you know, they're just little plastic things you place on top of the toilet, just makes it a little bit more manageable. Because sometimes a child who is a little bit small can feel a bit that they're, you know, unsafe up there, especially when you're bearing down. So again, often check the practicalities first before assuming some psychological trauma.
Yeah, I had a potty when I was a little boy. I loved that potty. I don't know what ever happened to it now. Happy days. Next question is, my 10-year-old son has Asperger's syndrome and knows that he has some differences to his peers, but does not have a name for it. We're planning to tell him about his diagnosis over the Christmas break. Do you have any advice on the best approach? That's a very interesting question.
It is, yeah. I mean, Asperger's syndrome is very common. For your listeners, it's a condition that exists on the autistic spectrum, which basically it's not a mild form of autism, but a higher functioning form of autism. And many of these children would struggle with kind of abstract thought, reading social cues and social nuances and things. So if you think about it, all children develop emotionally, socially, physically. But with Asperger's syndrome, the developmental trajectory is a bit slower on the social and emotional pieces. So they feel a little bit, they can, as they get older, they become more noticeable of their differences to their peers and sometimes maybe struggle with reading social cues, nuances, things like that. So the idea around whether you tell a child that they have Asperger's or not and how do you kind of sell that to them. With any sort of diagnosis like that, you don't want the label to define them.
You know?
So you're really wondering about, but you don't want them going through life feeling different and not knowing why that is or why they struggle with certain things. So it's really a parental discretion as to what you do. And it's similar with ADHD or anything else. You don't want it to take over. But with Asperger's syndrome, I mean, the best way to sell that idea is to list the kind of strengths and weaknesses, because people with Asperger's would have lots of strengths as well as some of the deficits that they might struggle with, and the same way that you or I have strengths and weaknesses. So I would normalize it. He's of that age where he's 10, you know, you're trying to kind of make it as understandable but not as threatening and overwhelming for him either. And any most kind of adult Asperger's syndrome people that I would have spoken to would say, you know, gosh, I would wish I'd known earlier what this was, because I've always felt that I haven't gotten conversations, or maybe I haven't picked up on things that other people have gotten. So that kind of sense of their own awareness of it will allow them to negotiate life with an awareness of their limitations, but also an awareness of their strengths.
Yes.
So I would think, you know, there's the great Tony Atwood is a professor, and he would write extensively on Asperger's syndrome. And I think he has some books that young people can read around their own diagnosis and ways to understand it and ways to negotiate things and compensate a little bit for it. So maybe direct them towards some kind of light literature around that. But one of the main indicators for prognosis with any childhood condition is parental understanding of the condition. So a parent who knows Asperger's and understands it, who can, you know, allow the child to develop their strengths and minimize the adversity maybe caused by their deficits, that child will do better than a parent who's less informed. So for yourselves, just make sure that you have a good understanding of what Asperger's is too, so that when you're explaining it to him, that you give him an accurate and realistic view of what he can do about it. But it's a difficult conversation to have, but I would say to them, you know, most young people with Asperger's can do very well, and once they understand their difficulties, they can, you know, successfully manage many environments in school and workplaces, etc. So
yeah,
you
know, and this kid seems to be aware enough to know that he's different.
Yeah.
So that's probably a good sign, actually.
And Tony Atwood would always say that's the point at which you introduce this conversation, when they start to realise they're different. And the gap, you know, sometimes the social gap may continue to widen as they go through school, as, you know, relationships teenagers get more socially complex. It's a useful time to introduce him to that, so that he has awareness of it for himself going into that kind of minefield.
Yeah.
But
it's like nobody understands teenage relationships.
Pretty much. And in some ways with Asperger's, it can seem quite that much simpler without those complexities. But I would certainly have the conversation. I would pitch it in a very positive positive way and just reassure them that a lot is known about this and that there's a lot of supports out there that can help people with it.
So. Yeah. A couple of comments on the little fella who enjoyed baths, now doesn't enjoy them so much. My daughter had the same problem at the same age. What we did was let her be part of the process, i.e. check the temperature of the bath, let her put her toys in before getting her changed. It took about a month, but now she gets so excited to get into it. I had the same bath problem with my son, around the same age, so I put on my shorts and got in the bath with him. After two baths, he was fine again, can't get him out now. That's two solutions. For the 3.5-year-old who's still coming in to sleep in the bed, in order to get our kids to stay in their own beds, my husband and I would make it very uncomfortable in our bed. So we would snuggle tight so they felt a bit squashed. And we'd move a lot and throw our arms around. After a couple of nights, they figured out the best sleep was in their beds. That's very smart kids, really. Right.
I think in psychology we've moved away from aversion therapy, but whatever works.
Now, next question. Again, this is a very difficult conversation. I'm a male who was sexually abused in the ages of 7 to 16. When, if ever, is a good time to tell my daughter she's 16?
Yeah, I mean, I would wonder why you'd feel the need to... tell that at the moment. Of course, your daughter knowing about your own history may help her to understand you a little bit better.
Yeah.
And, you know, think parental experiences like that undoubtedly have an impact on how we parent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We become hypersensitive to that maybe happening to our children or whatever it might be. So if it's interfering with how you're parenting her, she's 16, so maybe are you kind of hypersensitive about her going out to discos or things like that? Is there something that you're worried about and it's interfering with that process? If so, then it absolutely is at your own discretion at what whether you introduce the truth to her or not. But I wouldn't think that it's something you have to tell somebody, you know, in terms of that may come up in more a comfortable way in an adult to adult conversation. Your daughter herself is only 16, so she's only coming to terms with her own sexuality and she's only working, negotiating that space herself. Whether she needs to know about, you know, her dad's history, although it's been really difficult, I'm not entirely sure. I would tend to kind of wait and see if that is, if it's necessary to come up. If it's interfering with a relationship issue or if it's something that she's asking about or if it's something... I wouldn't feel there's need to put a deadline on that or tell her before any certain time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I kind of get... I wonder though, is this part... It's not so much should I tell them as much as I want to tell them.
Yeah.
So there's probably some onus on the dad. He wants to share this with her at some point.
Yeah, and I guess that.
Obviously it's very important to him.
And it's very important for her to understand him too. But I just wonder, is that want something that could wait until she's a little bit older or not? But again, and there's no easy way to have that conversation. Mm. But you'd hope that to him himself, maybe he's been through his own work and he's at a place where he's... you know, he can function very well without it causing too much distress for him now. And that's a better place to have a conversation than maybe if you're in the middle of work yourself. But that's a really difficult one. I would think, have a think about your daughter's well-being and as a teenager, how could she hear that? How will it affect her? And, you know, if you can wait till she's a little bit older and more adult-like, maybe it's in my opinion, maybe it's better off waiting a little bit.
Yeah, maybe it's significant from the dad's point of view because he says he was sexually abused between the ages of 7 and 16. He has been sexually abused when he was the same age as her, so...
And any experience of trauma in our own childhoods is vicariously lived out through our own children's lives as well. You know, if we've had a particularly adverse experience and your child is entering into that life stage themselves or is in the middle of it, you're going to have, and your antenna is going to be out, you're going to be hypersensitive to their experiences, and it undoubtedly can sometimes impact on how we parent. And as a parent, all you can do is trying to tune into that and own your own baggage and your own stuff and try and not let it interfere too much with how you parent your own children. But really, really difficult. I hope the father himself is feeling quite a bit more at ease with it now.
Yeah, that'll be tough to hear when she's a grown-up.
Yeah.
Don't be telling the 16-year-old. Yeah. You can see what do we all, like all parents kind of have that reaction of doing things that, well, my parents did this, so I'm going to do the direct opposite.
It's one or other. You either go, my mum did a fabulous job, so I'm going to replicate that.
Yeah.
Or my mum did a terrible job and I shall never be her.
Yeah.
And then turning into her anyway. As Freud said, if it's not one thing, it's your mother. But
yeah.
that kind of sense that, we either go one or the other, but it's certainly transgenerational parenting is completely a thing, and it absolutely influenced the blueprint of what we do is based on how we've been parented.
Yeah,
so,
in a weird way, we're parented by our grandparents, whether we like it or not.
Indeed,
in a way. A couple of suggestions for the young fellow with Asperger's. Different Like Me, and I think we did an item on this book, is a book about 14 famous people with Asperger's. It's a great book. I used to help tell my 11-year-old he had Asperger's. I dreaded telling him, but that book helped hugely. Says Paula. And we got another text in from someone else who says, I'm a teacher who works with children with Asperger's. I would advise accentuating the positives. The children I work with, while having social difficulties, have excelled at so much else. Try not to highlight how the differences make things difficult, but on how the differences can make you see the world in a whole new and exciting way.
Yeah. I think I'm reliably informed Picasso, Mozart and Einstein all had Asperger's. So they're three good role models, I would imagine.
Yeah, there is that kind of old cliche that, that you might have great social difficulties, but that you skew towards genius level. Is that just nonsense from the movies?
Yeah, sometimes. I think in terms of not all children are going to be protégés and, in terms of that sense. Certainly the creative talents and sometimes the great kind of clinical talents that children would have because their brain works in that way allows them to attention to details that we get distracted by and they don't.
So. Yeah. Coleman, thanks a million for coming into us. Happy Christmas to you.
Thanks
very much for your contributions over the year. Coleman Nocter there. Here's Andrea with the news.
Listen in every Wednesday at 3 p.m. here on Moncrief for more parenting advice from David Carey.